do what he had been trained to do. She wished she could have faced the prospect of his moon trip as well as he did. From the time she and the kids arrived back in Houston, it seemed the house was full of people. Marilyn was glad of that, glad for all the activity. It was one of the best customs of the space community. In times of greatest stress, the astronaut wives really came together and helped each other. There was always someone coming by with food or offering to watch the kids or run an errand. The squawk boxes, small speakers NASA had installed to pipe in the conversations between Apollo 8 and Mission Control, were a constant presence. She had kept one ear open, listening for her husband's voice, thrilled to hear him describe what he was seeing. Best of all were the television transmissions. It had been wonderful to see Jim on Sunday, smiling, wishing his mother a happy birthday. But her children had their own ways of absorbing the experience, or not absorbing it. Yesterday afternoon, when she got the children together for the second telecast, 13-year-old Jay was outside. She was barely able to get him into the house once the transmission began. When he did sit down, he was decidedly moody. He complained that he couldn't recognize his father's voice. He asked, "How fast are they going now?" The answer, that Apollo 8 had slowed to only a few thousand miles per hour, disappointed him. Whatever her children might think, Marilyn was spellbound to see pictures of the cloud-swept Earth and to hear Jim talking about it. On the screen, the TV networks superimposed Apollo 8's distance from home. Already it was 200,000 miles, hard enough for her to fathom, and it kept increasing as she watched. No sooner had the TV show ended than her children dispersed, and for the first time since the mission began, Marilyn was alone, with nothing to distract her from her darkest fears. On the squawk box, she heard Jerry Carr saying that Apollo 8 had crossed into the moon's gravitational influence. Marilyn wasn't particularly attuned to the technical details of her husband's work, but she understood one crucial thing. It was only a matter of hours until the men would fire their rocket engine and go into orbit, and that engine had to work perfectly, along with the entire complex machine her husband was flying. 20 hours later, that engine would have to be perfect one more time, or she would never see Jim again. She had known this all along, of course, but she had pushed the thought out of her consciousness. She said nothing about it to Jim, and she certainly wasn't going to discuss it with any of the other wives. There were certain unwritten rules here, carryovers from the test pilot business, and one of them was that you just don't talk about things like that. And so Marilyn had succeeded in banishing her terror, until yesterday afternoon, suddenly overwhelmed. With no one there to see, she broke down. Several minutes later, the doorbell rang. The daughter of a friend had come by with some food. Seeing that Marilyn had been crying, the girl told her mother about it, and by evening Marilyn's house was full of people once more. Her neighbors had come to spend the night with her, to share her anxiety and her hope for what was about to happen. Marilyn barely slept. During the night she came out of her bedroom to find the living room floor strewn with bodies, the sleeping forms of her dear friends. At 3:30 in the morning, everyone waited by the squawk box in silence as Apollo 8 headed for lunar orbit. She heard her husband say, "See you on the other side." And then, after an agony of waiting, his voice came through the static once more to announce success. All day today, Marilyn had tried to keep up with what was happening. She knew Jim was making landmark sightings, and she had a special interest in them. One night at the Cape before the launch, when she and Jim were alone, he had given her a present, a large black-and-white close-up photo of the moon from one of the unmanned probes. "What's this?" she asked. "I just wanted you to see where I'm going to name a mountain for you." Near the upper right-hand corner of the photo, Jim pointed to a triangular-shaped mountain sticking up from the dark plains of the Sea of Tranquility. Jim said it was one of the most important landmarks leading up to the landing site. He was going to call it Mount Marilyn. The name wouldn't be official, not unless it was approved by the International Astronomical Union, but that didn't bother her. As far as she was concerned, nobody could take away such a splendid gift. But on this Christmas Eve, after the trauma of the past 3 days, Marilyn needed something more. When Marilyn arrived at St. John's, the organist was practicing, and the church was filled with the sounds of Christmas hymns. Candles glowed everywhere. Father Reich had arranged to have them lit for her. At the altar, she celebrated a private communion. She left feeling renewed. And on the way home, she looked up, and to her amazement, there was the crescent moon. She could barely comprehend it. Jim was there. 3 days, 8 hours, 55 minutes, mission elapsed time.
"Well," Lovell yawned, "did you guys ever think that one Christmas Eve you'd be orbiting the moon?"
"Just hope we're not doing it on New Year's," said Anders with fighter pilot gallows humor. If Lovell got the joke, he didn't show it.
Hey, don't talk like that, Bill," he said quietly. "Think positive." Borman was awake now. It was getting to be a long day. They had been in orbit for nearly 14 hours, and they still had 6 hours to go before they would leave the moon. He could tell that his crew was tired. Lovell was hard at work on his landmark tracking. There was weariness in his voice whenever he spoke, and he was making mistakes. Several times he punched the wrong commands into the computer, triggering warning tones and startling Borman and Anders. Anders was probably tired, too, racing around to keep up with his photo plan. Borman knew how tired he had felt a few hours ago, before he got some rest. "The flight plan is just too full," Borman thought. They still had a TV show to do during the Ninth Revolution. Then the trans-Earth injection burn. Compared to that burn, Lovell's navigation was secondary, and so were Anders's photographs. The most important thing was getting home. Borman knew what he had to do. On the radio, they heard Mike Collins in Mission Control asking about some of Lovell's landmark sightings.
"Apollo 8, Houston, we'd like to clarify whether you intend to scrub control points 1, 2, and 3.
Borman keyed his mic. "We're scrubbing everything. I'll stay up and keep the spacecraft vertical and take some automatic pictures, but I want Jim and Bill to get some rest." Anders couldn't believe what he was hearing. The last thing he wanted to do was waste time sleeping in lunar orbit. He still had stereo pictures to take, dim light photography and filter work, and there were the targets north of track he had to finish up. He didn't feel tired. Was Borman serious?
Borman looked at the overcrowded flight plan. "Unbelievable, the details those guys put in here," he said to Anders. "A very good try, but completely unrealistic. I should have warned you."
"I'm willing to try it," Anders said gamely.
"No," Borman said, "you try it, and then we'll make another mistake."
Lovell started to speak, but Borman cut him off.
"I want you to get your ass in bed right now."
"I can do another rev," Lovell said.
"No, get to bed. Hurry up. I'm not kidding you. Go to bed."
Anders thought of all the unexposed film. He hid his frustration and asked his commander, "What do you want me to do?"
"Go to bed. We'll get that thing going when we get to daylight," Borman said, indicating the camera. "Then you guys go sack out for 2 hours."
So that was it. Like it or not, Borman had the authority to send them to bed in the interest of keeping his crew alert in a dangerous situation. Just now, Mike Collins radioed, "We agree with all your flight plan changes and have a beautiful backside. We'll see you next time around." No one in Mission Control was going to argue with Borman's decision. The radio fell silent once again as Apollo 8 coasted out of contact with Earth and into total darkness. Lovell had gone to his sleep station, but Anders remained in his couch, tending the cameras, hoping he might hold Borman off long enough to take some more pictures when they came into sunlight again. "We're doing fine," Borman said quietly. "Why don't you go to bed?" Anders was about as close to arguing as he'd ever been, but in a spacecraft, almost a quarter of a million miles from home, an argument with his commander would have been tantamount to mutiny. Still, he tried to hang on. "This is a closed issue," Borman said. Anders asked about the movie camera. "I'll just click it on when the time comes," Borman said. "You should see your eyes. Get to bed. Don't worry about the exposure business. God damn it, Anders, get to bed right now." Anders had no choice. "You want me to take some pictures?" Borman offered. "Okay, I'll take care of it all." As Anders headed for his sleeping bag, Borman was saying, "A quick snooze and you guys will feel a hell of a lot better."
An explosion of light came again over the far side, and the sun cast long shadows behind gray mountains and inside countless holes. In his sleeping bag, Anders craned his head to look past his couch through the tiny rendezvous window. Now he did feel tired. He could hardly keep his eyes open. Ironically, this was the best view of the moon he'd had on the whole flight. And something on the stark ground caught his eye, a feature that stood out from the pulverized sameness. He was all but certain he was looking at a region of old lava flows. This was what he'd been looking for, some sign of volcanic activity in the highlands. He could hear the Hasselblad clicking away on automatic in Bormann's window. He hoped they were getting this. Even if they were, Anders was aware that he was bringing home something more important. From lunar orbit, the Earth looked no bigger than the end of his thumb, and yet, on a cosmic distance scale, a quarter of a million miles was nothing at all. He knew that if he were going to go 100 times farther out, so far into the lonely dark that the Earth would shrink to a point of light, he would barely have left home. He couldn't help but think that the cosmos would continue to turn as it always had if suddenly there were no Earth. But how little that mattered when it appeared, blue and radiant, rising beyond the lifeless moon. In that moment, he saw a thing of inexplicable fragility. Later, he would liken it to a precious Christmas tree ornament. And if the Earth was only a mote of dust in the galaxy, that blue planet was everything to him and the creatures living on it. On his way into a fitful sleep, Anders began to realize, "We came all this way to explore the moon, and the most important thing is that we discovered the Earth." While Anders and Lovell slept, Bormann floated in the commander's left-hand seat. Spaceflight was quiet. There was none of the constant vibration of an airplane, the steady whine of jet engines. Whenever he fired a maneuvering thruster, there was a thump of solenoids opening the valves, but otherwise, as long as they kept the cabin fans turned off, there was only quiet. Bormann knew Anders was upset about the unplanned sleep period. Bormann liked Anders, but he understood that Anders just didn't have the experience to always see the big picture. Bormann had been flying 10 years longer. The real role of the commander on these missions wasn't to fly the spacecraft. There was precious little of that. It was to make the crucial decisions, and if ever there were a crucial need, it was to keep his crew sharp for the trans-Earth injection burn. But there was something else before the burn that Bormann had come to realize was extremely important. The flight plan called for 2 TV transmissions from lunar orbit. The second was set for the 9th rev, a couple of hours from now. The public affairs people had told him, "There will be more people watching those shows than have ever listened to a single human being in all of history say something appropriate." And with the help of a friend in Washington, Bormann found something. He had it reproduced on fireproof paper and placed in the back of the flight plan. After that, he didn't give it a minute's thought. Before the flight, he'd barely thought about the spiritual impact of going to the moon. But now that he was here, he couldn't deny it. To see the moon so desolate, looking like the Earth must have looked before life, or how it would look after nuclear war, was more sobering than he could have anticipated. But what moved him most was his own planet, the only color in the universe. To see the Earth rising beyond the moon on Christmas Eve was all the confirmation of a creator that Bormann needed. Now that he was here, he was glad to have that TV camera. He wanted to share his new perspective with humanity. What the three of them were about to do was perfect. It was time to get Lovell and Anders up for the telecast. 8:11 p.m. Houston time, Christmas Eve. 3 days, 13 hours, 40 minutes mission elapsed time. "Here it comes!" Bormann nearly shouted when he saw his world ascend once more from behind the desolate moonscape. On that Earth, in town squares and living rooms, pubs and offices, 500 million people were tuning in for a broadcast from the three men circling the moon. "This is Apollo 8, coming to you live from the moon," Bormann began. "Bill Anders, Jim Lovell, and myself have spent the day before Christmas up here, doing experiments, taking pictures, and firing our spacecraft engines to maneuver around. What we'll do now is follow the trail that we've been following all day. He'd gone over the plan with Lovell and Anders before they started transmitting. First, each man would say what impressed him most. Then, just before Apollo 8 flew into darkness, they would give a joint reading of the message. "The moon is a different thing to each one of us," Borman told his huge audience. "I know that my own impression is that it's a vast, lonely, forbidding type of existence or expanse of nothing." His words came out with an awed, sober cadence. "And it certainly would not appear to be a very inviting place to live or work." When Lovell's turn came, he spoke eloquently of two worlds, the lonely one he was orbiting and the grand oasis he had left behind. Anders described the moon's spectacular appearance near lunar sunrise and sunset, where long shadows made the landscape look jagged and forbidding. For about 20 minutes, the three men took their viewers on a tour of the landmarks passing below them. Over the Sea of Crises they flew, and then the Sea of Fertility, and then the Marsh of Sleep, and then at last the Sea of Tranquility. In the distance, they could see the place of long shadows. They would soon be crossing into night. Anders gave the introduction. "We are now approaching lunar sunrise. And for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message we would like to send to you." Anders held the flight plan in front of him and began to read. "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, 'Let there be light.' And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness." Now it was Lovell's turn. "And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day." As Lovell read, Anders thought, "We're trying to say something fundamental. This isn't just another space mission. It's a new beginning for all of us." "And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day." The shadows lengthened on the Sea of Tranquility as Borman closed the reading. "And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called the seas. And God saw that it was good." And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with, "Good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth." El Lago, Texas. The night was crisp and clear in Houston. When the verses from Genesis came down, a crescent moon shone high overhead, and after the telecast ended, more than one witness went outside to look at it. In El Lago, Susan Borman had a house full of friends and relatives. Susan was a model of composure. In other words, she seemed no different now that her husband was circling the moon than she was at any other time. The other wives could not look at Susan Borman without feeling some amazement. Always she was an impeccable military wife. White gloves for formal occasions, hair always perfect, always neat and well-dressed. Her clothing alone was an accomplishment on an astronaut's salary. Valerie Anders, raising 4 children, had to scrimp on her wardrobe, and when her mother saw her on television, she would ask Valerie later, "Why are you always wearing the same dress?" The answer was that it was the only nice one she had. This Christmas Eve, Susan had carried herself with characteristic poise. She'd been up all the previous night, listening to the conversations between Houston and the moon on the squawk boxes. In the morning she'd gone to church, pausing outside to speak with reporters, and then back home by midday. After the evening telecast, Valerie Anders left her house,
also full of people, to be with Susan during the critical trans-Earth injection burn. Now the two women and several visitors waited by the squawk box in the Borman kitchen. They heard the voice of Ken Mattingly, the young, serious astronaut serving as Capcom, read up a long list of numbers and technical shorthand. It was almost midnight when Mattingly advised, 3 minutes to LOS. Loss of signal as Apollo 8 flew behind the moon for what everyone hoped would be the last time. All systems are go, Apollo 8, Mattingly said. Susan heard her husband say simply, thank you. Then the squawk box fell silent. And now came the worst moment of her long, private agony. Her ordeal had begun the previous August, as soon as she learned of Frank's moon mission. From that moment, she'd been sure he wasn't going to come back. She was furious with the NASA managers for sending him. There was nothing new about this terror. It had been with her off and on ever since Frank started flying, but it didn't take long for her to learn what was required of her. Keep smiling, keep your fears to yourself. In the squadron, she and Frank had seen some of the men wash out because of wives who couldn't keep their worries to themselves. After a while, it affected a man's concentration. She knew it was wrong to complain, but when they were at Edwards and Frank was assigned to fly Zoom tests in that silver beast they called the F-104 in a pressure suit she knew was outdated, she'd pleaded with him not to go. He'd said to her in exasperation, look, there is something you've got to get through your head. There's more to this life than just living. And she had only begun to understand it then, that nothing mattered to him more than carrying out his mission. Over the years, she embraced her role and even picked up some of her husband's fighter pilot bravado. When someone in his squadron got killed, she told herself, that would never have happened to Frank. She did the same thing when they came to NASA, until the fire. When Ed White died, this magnificent physical specimen, Susan realized that no one, not even Frank, could have gotten out of that burning command module alive, and she knew that as long as he stayed an astronaut, he was waiting his turn to die. That was when Susan began to escape into alcohol. No one knew. She drank in private and was careful never to appear intoxicated around her family. It wasn't hard to hide her drinking from Frank. He spent most of 1967 at North American. She told herself her own problems were minor compared to the stress he was under, and when he came home for an overnight visit, she made sure there were no troubles to greet him. She blamed her unhappiness on herself. And when Frank accepted the circumlunar mission, she acted as if nothing were wrong. But it was one thing to pull off the charade for her husband. It was another to manage it under the media microscope. On launch day, Susan's facade finally cracked. Not with the reporters who were camped on the lawn, she did fine with them. It happened when the cameras invaded her house. Producer David Wolper, who was making a documentary on Apollo 8, had asked NASA for permission to film Susan and the children as they watched the launch and the translunar injection burn. Dreading this, Susan had voiced her reluctance, but Frank told her, I'm sorry, but NASA wants us to do it. It's for the good of the program, and that's the way it's going to be. Wolper arrived at dawn with a backlot's worth of camera equipment. They put microphones in the kitchen cabinets to catch bits of candid conversations, and they left with footage of a very anxious Susan Borman. However worried she might have looked on camera, that was nothing compared to the anguish inside her, and when Chris Kraft paid a visit a couple of nights later, she made no attempt to cover up. If you think the fire was bad, wait until these guys get stranded in lunar orbit. It would take days for the condemned men to die, circling until their oxygen ran out. She could just imagine what the press would do with that story. She could imagine the NASA man who would come to tell her that Frank was dead, and she could picture the big memorial service they would hold. With a strange kind of logic, she decided that no government official would write her husband's eulogy. That was her job, and she told Kraft that, too. But that was her only outcry. Her husband was commanding the first circumlunar voyage, and if she was expected to play the smiling, confident leader of his support crew, then that is what she would do. 20 hours ago, just before Apollo 8 slipped behind the moon for the first time, she had sent him a special message via Jerry Carr in Mission Control.
The custard is in the oven at 350.
No comprendo, she heard Frank say, and then a moment later,
Roger.
He understood. It was an old line from their Edwards days. Frank used to say to her, you worry about the custard, and I'll worry about the flying. She wanted him to know she was playing along. But now, with only silence from the squawk box and nothing to do but wait, it was all she could do to keep her composure as the time neared when Apollo 8 was to re-establish radio contact. She could not have known that in Mission Control Kraft was enduring his own agony of waiting, and that even the engineers who knew the SPS engine like the back of their hands were sweating out this silence like nothing before.
4. It's all over but the shouting. Wednesday, December 25th, Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston. The clocks in Mission Control crept toward a mission elapsed time of 89 hours, 28 minutes, and 39 seconds, and the tension was palpable. If the trans-Earth injection burn went as planned, Apollo 8 would reemerge at that time, 19 minutes past midnight on Christmas Day, if the engine didn't fire. Contact would come as much as 8 minutes later. The mission clock read, 89 hours, 28 minutes, 39 seconds. Seconds passed in silence. Suddenly a cheer went up from the flight controllers. Telemetry from Apollo 8 began to register on their screens. It took a few more minutes for Earthbound antennas to lock onto the signal, and finally they heard Jim Lovell's voice.
Houston, Apollo 8, over.
Hello, Apollo 8, Mattingly replied, loud and clear. Please be informed there is a Santa Claus.
That's affirmative, Mattingly responded gratefully. You are the best ones to know.
Once the mission is done, go home. Not only was that Frank Borman's attitude, it was most astronauts. Last August, in Chris Kraft's office, Borman had asked the trajectory people to get him home in 2 days, but the speed required would have trimmed the margins of accuracy on the trajectory dangerously close, as well as subjecting the command module to undesirable stresses during its re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. Borman settled for 2.5 days. The voyage began with a spectacular view of the entire moon as Apollo 8 climbed away from it like a jet on afterburner. Then there was nothing to do but tend the systems, listen to news reports from Mission Control, headlined by messages of congratulations that were pouring in from around the world, and catch up on sleep. Around mid-afternoon, the men gave a televised tour of their home away from home. While Anders demonstrated how to prepare a freeze-dried meal in space, Borman told Mike Collins in Houston, "I hope you all had better Christmas dinners today than us." But Borman spoke too soon. When the TV show was over, they discovered a surprise waiting for them in Apollo 8's food locker, wrapped in foil and tied with red and green ribbons. Real turkey with stuffing and cranberry sauce. This was a so-called wet pack meal developed by the military, one of the innovations Borman had fought to keep off the flight. It was also by far the best meal of the voyage. And there was another surprise, courtesy of Father Slayton. 3 tiny bottles of brandy. Borman was annoyed.
"Put it back," he told his crew. He wasn't about to risk someone in the public raising a ruckus. If they made a single mistake on the rest of the flight, the brandy would get the blame. The bottles went unopened. Lovell would say later that neither he nor Anders had any intention of opening them. But there were other packages, and these were meant to be opened. Christmas gifts to the 3 men from their wives. Susan Borman had sent cufflinks made from a pair of St. Christopher's medals that had gone through World War I with the late husband of a dear friend. From Marilyn Lovell, there were cufflinks and a man in the moon tie tack, and from Valerie Anders, a gold 8 tie tack, replete with moonstone. For Bill Anders, the trip home was a long, quiet, and boring fall. At one point, Mike Collins mentioned that his son Michael had asked who was driving up there. Anders replied, "I think Isaac Newton is doing most of the driving right now."
This should have been a welcome chance to catch up on all the sleep he'd missed on the way out, but Anders, at least, wasn't having much luck there. Somehow it worked out that when he was trying to sleep, Borman and Lovell were awake, and they got into small talk. Because of Borman's bad ear, they yelled a lot. "You think the Oilers have a chance?" Anders was only thankful that in zero-G he could survive on so little sleep, because he wasn't getting much. At the other end of this fall lay the high-speed re-entry into the atmosphere. When Anders was 4 years old, the circus came to the small California town of Vallejo, where his family was visiting, and his grandfather took him to see it. There was an enormous tent, and a man climbed up a ladder. To his young eyes, it looked about 8 stories high, and dove off into what seemed a tiny tub of water. The boy talked about it for weeks. Anders hadn't thought of that circus dive in many years, but it came back to him when he looked across the lunar distance at the Earth. That's what that guy did in Vallejo. He couldn't help but think, "I sure hope we hit that thing." Flying the re-entry was a task reserved for the command module computer. If it worked, Borman would just sit there and monitor. If it broke down, he would have to take over and fly it, and he'd worked hard to help create the techniques to do that. They'd probably be off target for splashdown. Nobody could fly it as well as the computer, but they'd be alive. The tough part was going to be flying through the periods of high G's. It was hard enough in the training runs in the centrifuge, when you could barely lift your arm, but after 6 days of weightlessness, it would be even tougher. Flying the re-entry was one piloting job Borman would just as soon not have. Even a perfect re-entry would subject the command module to extreme stress. In Gemini, the ride down from Earth orbit was long and slow, but Apollo 8 would be coming in at 25,000 miles per hour, and the forces of heat and deceleration would be far greater. Temperatures around the command module would soar to 5,000 degrees centigrade, and their lives would depend on the heat shield on the craft's blunt end. It was made from a substance called phenolic epoxy resin, whose protection came not from resisting the intense heat. No one had found an alloy that could do that and still be light enough to use on a spacecraft, but from giving in to it. Just as the boiling water in a kettle absorbs the heat of the stove and keeps the pot from overheating, the heat shield would become white hot, then char and melt away, taking with it the awesome heat of re-entry. And when the fiery plunge through the atmosphere was finished, there would still be one more critical event, the blossoming of 3 80-foot parachutes to lower Apollo 8 to the waters of the Pacific. For Frank Borman, that would mark the end of his astronaut career. He had decided beforehand that Apollo 8 would be his last mission. Slayton had all but offered him the first landing, but Borman turned it down. He appreciated Slayton's confidence, he told him, but he doubted he could get his crew ready for a landing mission in time. He knew they would be disappointed, Anders in particular, but Borman had decided it was time to move on. If Apollo was a war, then a crucial battle was almost won. Let someone else have the final victory. In Borman's mind, the truth of it, which would have come as a great surprise to Anders and Lovell, was that Apollo 8 had been less difficult than he'd expected, far less stressful than Gemini 7. Apollo 8 was turning out to be a wonderful finale to his test flight career. There was only one thing Borman wanted now. After the ordeal of Gemini 7, nothing compared with the high he felt standing weak-legged on the carrier deck, his mission accomplished. And now, as Apollo 8 sped homeward, that was what Borman was looking forward to most of all. Friday, December 27th, 9:31 a.m. Houston time. 6 days, 2 hours, 40 minutes mission elapsed time. Borman: "Look who's coming there, would you?" Anders: "Yep." Borman: "Just like they promised." Lovell: "What?" Borman: "The moon." With just 6 minutes to go until re-entry, the brief appearance of an old friend, rising beyond the dark curve of the Earth's night side at exactly the moment the trajectory specialists had predicted, was welcome reassurance that Apollo 8 was aimed right for the middle of the corridor. Just minutes earlier, Borman had flipped a switch to cast off the now unneeded service module. Unprotected, it would meet its end as a shower of meteors over the darkened Pacific. Inside the command module, the conversation sounded like a movie script.
"Well, men, we're getting close," Borman said. "There's no turning back now," Anders said.
"Old Mother Earth has us," Lovell said. He was right. Though they could not sense it yet, the men were returning to the Earth as they had left, at fantastic speed.
"It's getting hazy out there," Anders said.
"Does that mean anything? Every time you fire a thruster?" Now Borman gave the spacecraft to the computer. From here on, the autopilot would fly them in. He glanced out the window.
"God, it is hazy out there, isn't it?"
"That sunrise," Anders said.
"Yeah, that might be sunrise," Lovell added quickly, but suddenly they all knew it wasn't sunrise at all, but something far more strange, the glow of ionized gas.
The command module was slamming into the outermost fringes of atmosphere so fast that atoms were being stripped of their electrons, creating a glowing plasma. Borman and Lovell had seen a similar glow on their Gemini reentries, but never this bright. And it was only beginning.
"God damn," Borman said. "This is going to be a real ride. Hang on."
Still, they were weightless in their couches, but soon they knew the command module would begin to decelerate. A light on the instrument panel would come on when the G-forces measured 0.05. At that moment, the real reentry would begin. From then on, things would happen fast and furious.
"Got it. 05G, said Borman. "Hang on."
"And they're building up," called Lovell. G-forces mounted as the command module slammed into the denser layers of air.
"Call out the Gs," Anders reminded Lovell. "We're 1G.
After 6 days in weightlessness, 1G felt like 3. Seconds later, the men were pressed into their couches with tremendous force. Lovell groaned with the sudden deceleration.
5!
Lowell's voice was thick with the strain of 5 times his normal weight.
6!
An elephant was sitting on their chests, but the worst was over. Within moments, the G-forces began to slack off. The command module had slowed to orbital speed now. Borman, Lovell, and Anders were captives of the Earth once more. A cold, white light flooded the windows, as bright as daylight. It was like flying inside a neon tube. Borman had never seen anything so weird. He glanced over at Lovell and Anders, who were bathed in this unearthly glow. Outside, Anders could see flaming objects, undoubtedly tiny pieces of the burning heat shield, flying past his window. Every so often, what looked to be a fist-sized chunk shot by, and Anders thought, "Jesus, we can't take too many of those." He kept waiting to feel heat building up at his back. It never came. While the heat shield charred and melted, inside the cabin the temperature hardly rose a degree. Far below, to those who were fortunate enough to see it, the command module was a glowing meteor in the night sky. The computer, meanwhile, was doing a miraculous job. Under its control, the command module turned and soared along a precisely crafted roller coaster ride. Apollo 8 dipped down into the denser air, then ascended briefly for a respite from the heat and the G-loads, then dipped and climbed once more. At last, it headed down for the final descent, falling through the pre-dawn darkness like a stone. Borman said,
"It's all over but the shouting."
Now they were back in radio contact with Houston. At about 100,000 feet, the altimeter sprang to life. The command module plunged toward the Pacific at 1,000 feet a second. All that was left was the parachutes. The command module cleared 30,000 feet, and there was a loud crack as the parachute cover flew off. Then another crack.
"There go the drogues," Borman said, announcing the release of 3 small stabilizing parachutes.
Now there was a loud whoosh of air as a vent opened to let cabin pressure equalize with the outside.
"Should be approaching 10K, Anders called. "Stand by for the mains in 1 second. They heard a crack.
"You see it?" asked Lovell.
"Can't see a thing," Borman said, peering up into the night.
But the altimeter had slowed its readings. The chutes had to be okay. Now, A loud mechanical groan filled the cabin as the excess fuel was dumped overboard and the command module thrusters spat flame. In their pale light, Borman and Anders glimpsed three great canopies of red and white. Beautiful, perfect parachutes. Now their headsets filled with the chatter of recovery helicopters. Apollo 8, Airbus 1, you have been reported on radar as southwest of the ship at 25 miles. Welcome home, gentlemen. We'll have you aboard in no time. As Borman, Lovell, and Anders went through the checklist for splashdown, cabin pressure relief valves closed. Got it. Direct O2, open. Open. They were all but drowned out by the radio traffic. This is Recovery 2. I see the chutes. I see the light level with me at precisely 4,000 feet. Anders was yelling at the top of his lungs. Floodlights to post-landing, for Borman and Lovell to hear him. This is Yorktown. Affirmative, we do have capsule in sight. Turn him down, Anders said. Christ, we can't get anything done. All right, Borman asked. Anything else we missed? Negative, said Anders. Stand by to release the mains. That was a bit of teamwork that Borman and Anders had worked out in advance. When they hit the water, Anders would push the right circuit breaker, and Borman would flip a switch to cast off the chutes. Otherwise, the wind might drag them through the water until they tipped over. Brace yourselves, Anders called. Well, wait, Borman said. We've got 2,000 feet yet. I don't know if we have or not, Lovell said. They were reporting us lower. Oh, they were? Moments later, the command module hit the water with a tremendous jolt. Water poured in through an open vent, so much that for an instant Anders thought the spacecraft's hull had cracked with the impact. The water poured all over Borman, who was poised to release the chutes, and before he could do anything, the wind dragged the command module upside down. Now it was up to three balloons in the spacecraft's nose to inflate and set them upright. Meanwhile, Borman, Lovell, and Anders hung in their straps upside down in a dark, warm, suddenly quiet spacecraft, tossed about by a rough sea. 10-foot swells set them pitching and rolling, while helicopters circled overhead, waiting for the first light of dawn before dispatching swimmers. Anders Riley took stock of the situation. Here they were, in the middle of the Pacific, hanging upside down in the dark like bats, with bits of trash from the command module floor raining down past them. Not quite what came to mind for returning space conquerors. Borman had never had a strong stomach for sea voyages, and it wasn't long before he was sick. This time Lovell and Anders showed him no mercy, saying, "What do you expect from a West Point ground pounder?" At last they were upright again, and the swimmers had arrived to secure a flotation collar around the command module. From one of the circling helicopters came a voice. "Apollo 8, is the moon made of Limburger cheese?" "No," radioed Anders, "it's made of American cheese." The words of the returned moon voyagers belied the condition inside Apollo 8. Borman, Lovell, and Anders were positively grungy. For one thing, they needed a shave. Borman less so than his crew, but he'd taken so much grief about his scrawny beard after 2 weeks on Gemini 7 that this time he'd arranged for an electric razor to be waiting for him in the recovery helicopter. After 6 days of living in a flying toilet, they didn't even notice how bad it smelled inside Apollo 8. But when that first swimmer opened the hatch, he reeled backwards as if he'd been kicked in the head. Inside, the three men noticed a strange smell, too. Fresh sea air. Life rafts waited outside the hatch, and minutes later the chopper lowered a billy pew net and lofted each man, one at a time. As Borman ascended, he glanced down at Spacecraft 103, his ship, bobbing in the Pacific, and felt gratitude. And a few minutes later, he stood smiling with crew on the deck of the USS Yorktown, while hundreds of sailors cheered, waving American flags in the morning light. It was the middle of the night when Borman, Lovell, and Anders stepped off the plane at Ellington Air Force Base, clean, rested, dressed in caps and blue coveralls. Susan was there with her sons to greet Frank and take him home. They arrived in El Lago to a celebration of candles and welcome home signs. Her husband had flown around the moon. Would anything ever be the same? Well, yes, her husband would. As they went into the house, Frank spotted the dog's dinner sitting in a corner uneaten. He turned to his sons and said, "Why is that still sitting there? You know the rules." Not that she was surprised, but she had to laugh. In the last days of 1968, there was a single image. Pure. Awesome. Even holy. To counter a year's worth of violence. It was a photograph of the Earth rising beyond the battered and lifeless face of the moon. Apollo 8 was more than a successful space mission. It was a bright moment for a nation experiencing its first pangs of self-doubt. Even as Vietnam threatened to become a war America could not win, here was an American triumph. Not long after Borman, Lovell, and Anders were back in Houston, Borman got a telegram from someone he had never met. It said, "You saved 1968. And for NASA, 1969 held great promise. The way was clear now for them to go the rest of the way, to meet Kennedy's challenge to land on the moon. In his Christmas cards, Alan Bean, backup lunar module pilot for Apollo 9, wrote, "It's going to be a wonderful year for all of us." Chapter 4. Before This Decade Is Out. 1. The Parley. The first moon voyages were back on Earth, and the impact of their voyage was considerable. In one masterstroke, Apollo 8 had given the United States a clear lead in the space race, publicly at least. The Soviets were now talking about missions in Earth orbit without even mentioning manned lunar flights, as if that had been their plan all along. At NASA headquarters, no one was ready to write off the competition. Intelligence reports said the Soviets were still working on a super booster for their own moon landing program. But in Houston, everyone felt the surging confidence that took hold of the manned spacecraft center. For the first time, John Kennedy's end-of-the-decade lunar landing deadline seemed within reach. Indeed, if everything went according to plan, NASA would make it with months to spare. The architects of Apollo were talking about a landing for Apollo 11, slated for a July liftoff, earlier than anyone, including the oddsmakers in the astronaut office, would have dared guess. To land on the moon, after only 4 manned Apollo missions? To many, the plan seemed wildly optimistic, considering the tremendous challenges that lay ahead. The lunar module, which had passed an unmanned test in Earth orbit, had never been flown with a man aboard. The spacesuit designed for the first moonwalks had never been tested in the vacuum of space. No Apollo crew had attempted the intricate and crucial rendezvous between the lander and the command module, which would have to be practiced not only in Earth orbit, but around the moon. Remarkably, NASA was planning to soar over those hurdles with just 2 missions, Apollo 9, an Earth orbit flight crammed to the hilt with tests, and Apollo 10, a full-up dress rehearsal of the landing mission in lunar orbit. The lunar module's manned debut was the primary goal for the Earth orbit Apollo 9 mission, commanded by Gemini veteran Jim McDivitt, and set for a late winter launch. McDivitt's team, veteran Dave Scott and a red-headed, irreverent rookie named Rusty Schweikert, would practice the critical rendezvous maneuvers and give the entire Apollo spacecraft a thorough workout. Schweikert would perform Apollo's first spacewalk to test the spacesuit and life support backpack. By any measure, Apollo 9 would be an extraordinarily ambitious mission in May, if nothing went wrong on Apollo 9. And that was a big if. Tom Stafford's all-veteran Apollo 10 crew would head for lunar orbit for the dress rehearsal. While John Young circled alone in the command module, Stafford and his lunar module pilot, Gene Cernan, would steer their LM within 50,000 feet of the moon and in so doing demonstrate every maneuver for the landing mission save the final descent to the surface. Then they would rejoin Young and head home. Both of these missions were staggering in their complexity. By comparison, Apollo 8 had almost been simple. Both would have to be nearly perfect for Apollo 11 to attempt a landing in July. Attempt was really the right word. There was no assurance that the first mission assigned to land would succeed. Nevertheless, as 1969 opened, there was more than a little speculation, both inside and outside the astronaut office, on who would get the chance to try. Of course,
Anyone who went through the arithmetic of Slayton's crew rotation had a good idea of who it would be. The crew that backed up Apollo 8 would skip 9 and 10 and fly the next mission, Apollo 11. Pete Conrad had figured that out some time ago, and he didn't like the answer. Since early 1967, Conrad and his crew had been the backups for Jim McDivitt's team, training for the first manned LM flight. Conrad and his lunar module pilot, Al Bean, had racked up hundreds of hours in the lunar module simulator, helping the engineers wring out the bugs in its computer software. Conrad hoped that with that kind of experience under his belt, if the timing worked out just right, he might one day find himself in command of the first lunar landing. Conrad would have readily admitted it. He wanted the first landing as much as anyone in the astronaut office. And the numbers were on his side. He was backing up Apollo 8, and that meant he'd fly Apollo 11, a feasible, if optimistic, bet for the landing. But Conrad's fortunes changed when NASA decided to send Apollo 8 around the moon. In August 1968, when Frank Borman's crew swapped places with Jim McDivitt's, so did their backup teams, and Conrad's place in line went to Neil Armstrong. Now it looked as though Armstrong's team, a crew with hardly any lunar module experience, was about to be assigned to the landing. That's what bothered Conrad most. After all, he and Bean knew more about flying the LM than any other astronauts. One day, Conrad took his misgivings to Slayton, who said what he always said, any crew can fly any mission. And besides, Conrad knew, Slayton wasn't about to pull him off backup duty for Apollo 9, where he was sorely needed. Of course, there was still a chance that his own mission, Apollo 12, might turn out to be the first landing, and around the Space Center in January 1969, more than a few bets were on Conrad. What Conrad did not know, because Slayton told next to no one, was that Slayton had almost thrown his any crew can fly any mission credo out the window. For years, the media had tried to break the code of Slayton's crew selections, theorizing that he must be picking the best astronaut for each mission, carefully matching crewman for some combination of skills and temperaments. Slayton also knew that some NASA managers wanted him to hand-pick crews, and he had always resisted. He knew anything other than an orderly crew rotation would make a shambles of astronaut office morale. But what about the first lunar landing? Was that important enough to put the very best astronaut in command? NASA's upper echelon had always considered Jim McDivitt and Frank Borman as prime candidates for that mission, and in truth, both men were highly regarded by Slayton. Late in 1968, Slayton reasoned that as the only veteran lunar crew, Borman's team would have an edge that might make the difference between success and failure. And on the chance that Borman did not succeed, Slayton was ready to put McDivitt's crew right onto Apollo 12 instead of Pete Conrad's. Slayton knew he'd face a firestorm of protest from the pilots waiting in line. No astronaut had ever been ushered directly from one prime slot to another, but he was willing to put up with that. But Slayton's plan fell by the wayside in the fall of 1968 when Borman turned down the offer. Many years later, the myth would endure that somehow NASA had hand-picked Neil Armstrong to command the first lunar landing mission. In one version, it was because he was the best test pilot among the astronauts. In another, because he was a civilian and NASA was eager to avoid any connotations of militarism on the first landing. Both theories were wrong. In truth, the crew for the ultimate test flight was chosen not by design, but by chance, just as Slayton had always said it would be. On Monday, January 6th, 1969, Slayton summoned Armstrong to his office and told him that he was planning to assign his crew to Apollo 11. Buzz Aldrin would be his lunar module pilot, and Mike Collins, who had fully recovered from his surgery, would be his command module pilot. It wouldn't be official for a few days, but assuming it was approved, they would be in line for the first lunar landing. Neil Armstrong had gone to work that Monday morning with only a suspicion, not an assurance of what might come his way. Looking back, he would say that he was very pleased, but not wildly elated, as he left Slayton's office. the sobering reality was that a host of untried procedures would have to be defined, evaluated, and finally boiled down into neatly scripted checklists before he and his crew could even begin their most intensive training. There were just 7 months for him, Collins, and Aldrin to master the complexities of the most demanding space mission ever attempted. Even more significant in Armstrong's mind on this January day was the lunar module and the tremendous challenges facing Apollos 9 and 10. The odds that both missions would be flawless, as NASA's plan required, were small indeed. Armstrong was not at all sure that when July came, landing on the moon would really be his mission. It was a day, the first of many, I'll bet, of walking on eggs, where normalcy tinged with hysteria. Joan Aldrin didn't usually write entries like that in her diary, but that is how she described life on the day after she learned her husband was on the crew of Apollo 11. In 1954, on one of their first dates, Buzz had informed her that people would land on the moon sometime in this century, and she had thought, how ridiculous. When she met Buzz, the nickname came from his baby sister, whose efforts to pronounce brother came out buzzer. Joan was working on an acting career. She did a little television work, a walk-on part on Playhouse 90, a few lines on Climax. Years later, in Houston, she would help open the Clear Creek Country Theater, but late in 1954 she put all that on hold to marry this young blonde fighter pilot and to go with him to Germany. And aside from wild statements about moon trips, Joan thought she had married a fighter pilot like the others in his Air Force squadron. She learned otherwise when he traded the flight line for the classroom in 1959 as a graduate student at MIT. At first, Buzz had intended to stay only long enough to earn a master's, then apply to the test pilot school at Edwards. But the academic life appealed to them both, and soon he was working on his doctorate. He was also talking about the astronaut program. Buzz knew NASA required test pilot credentials, but he was betting that would change. In the meantime, he was hard at work on his thesis on piloting techniques for space rendezvous. He chose it knowing that rendezvous would become a critical part of NASA's moon program, when astronauts returning from the lunar surface would have to link up with their command ship. At MIT, Joan discovered a side of Buzz she hadn't seen before, his extraordinary intelligence. He would pace the floor and talk excitedly about his thesis work. She wanted to support him in any way she could, and that meant she listened, but she didn't comprehend very much of what she heard. There were many people who didn't understand Buzz. His mind was on things that were far removed from day-to-day existence. Like many very smart, intense people, he wasn't too comfortable socially. He understood the intricacies of orbital rendezvous, but he didn't know how to make simple, light conversation. But he was always steady, always calm, always logical. He was her anchor, and she was, quite simply, in awe of him. Not until years later, when Buzz finally got his chance to fly in space, did he show a crack in his armor, and even then, she didn't immediately recognize it. Buzz came home from Gemini 12 elated at the flight's success, but that was followed by a brief and minor depression. She had never seen him like that before. When she thought about it, she realized that he was going through the same letdown she experienced whenever a show closed. She didn't know when she would get to do another one. Now Buzz was going to be in another show, and it was the big one. When he told her, she put up a calm and happy front, but whenever she thought about the lunar landing, she felt sick. This was something new for Joan. She hadn't been afraid when Buzz was getting ready for Gemini 12, despite the fact that he was going to spend a total of 5 hours walking in space, more than any previous astronaut. Spacewalks had been done before, she told herself, and Buzz would just do his better. But this time the old confidence wasn't working. No one had ever landed on the moon. March 7th, 1969, Manned Spacecraft Center. In the quiet of mission control, Buzz Aldrin stood behind the Capcom's console and listened to the voices from space. He felt at home here. In some ways, he preferred the company of the flight controllers to the other astronauts.
He had never shared the fighter jock bravado of his colleagues, but among craftsmen he felt the bond of common academic interests. With them, Aldrin had helped to work out the techniques for the events now unfolding 155 miles up. The climactic moment of Apollo 9 was underway.
"Okay, Dave, I can see you. Boy, are you bright. Okay, I'm at 950 feet, 10 feet per second."
To the rest of the world, the 10-day Earth orbit mission of Apollo 9 must have seemed decidedly mundane, coming as it did on the heels of the first flight around the moon. But few astronauts would have been surprised to learn that Jim McDivitt had turned down the circumlunar mission to stick with this one. They wouldn't have said so publicly, but many saw Apollo 8 as little more than a ride, no real flying involved. But Apollo 9 was a test pilot's feast. In truth, it was far more difficult, more ambitious, and in some ways more dangerous than Apollo 8. For the engineers, the demands of getting two manned spacecraft ready for flight were headache enough. The simulators kept breaking down. There were days, during training, when McDivitt would go home and tell his wife it couldn't be done. It would never all come together in time. Miraculously, it did, and McDivitt's crew was launched on March 3rd. They figured that if they accomplished half of what was in the flight plan, they'd call the mission a success. By March 7th, the mission's fifth day, they'd already come close to doing it all. Besides a complete shakedown of their command module, Gumdrop, they'd activated the docked lunar module, Spider, and test-fired its descent engine. Schweikert had suffered a debilitating bout with motion sickness that almost canceled his spacewalk, but he recovered in time to go outside, wearing the lunar spacesuit and backpack, for 38 minutes. And today came the climax. While Scott remained in Gumdrop, McDivitt and Schweikert climbed into Spider and undocked. For 6 hours, the two men flew a craft with no heat shield, venturing up to 111 miles from the safety of their command ship. Then they fired their engine and headed back to Scott, beginning the long and intricate dance called Space Rendezvous. As Buzz Aldrin knew only too well, an astronaut flying a rendezvous couldn't use the instincts he'd honed in airplanes. This was a completely different way of flying. Rendezvous was a domain ruled by the arcane statutes of orbital mechanics. A spacecraft in orbit is like a ball bearing whizzing around inside a deep, curved funnel. A ball thrown into the funnel will orbit at a height and speed that depends on the amount of energy it has. A ball with a lot of energy will circle at the upper end of the funnel. One with less energy will circle lower down. If the ball is down toward the neck of the funnel, it will circle faster than one up near the mouth, even though it has less energy. If the balls are spacecraft around the Earth, the funnel becomes the invisible well of gravity which all orbiting objects must fight in order to stay in orbit. The closer the spacecraft is to Earth, the stronger the force of gravity, and the faster it must go to balance that pull. The farther away it is, the weaker gravity's pull, and the slower the spacecraft travels. From a pilot's standpoint, the analogy makes clear the most important rule of orbital mechanics. Height and speed are inextricably linked. To slow down, the spacecraft must be kicked into a higher orbit by adding energy with a burst from a rocket. Conversely, speeding up requires dropping into a lower orbit by using the rocket as a brake. A pair of astronauts who start out behind their target must lower their orbit until they catch up, but not for too long, or they will overtake it. If they start out ahead, they must raise their orbit, go slow for a while, and then descend in time to meet their target. Every burst of speed, every bit of braking changes their height and therefore their speed. Catching the moving target and staying there once they've arrived becomes a feat of great complexity. At MIT, Aldrin had foreseen the importance of rendezvous to NASA's moon program. He knew that special onboard computers were being developed for Gemini and Apollo to help astronauts fly a rendezvous. But what if the computer broke down? With the help of specialists in MIT's instrumentation laboratory, Aldrin worked out the techniques the pilot could use to take over and fly the final stages of a rendezvous by hand. At NASA, Aldrin had been instrumental in designing the rendezvous schemes for Gemini and Apollo. He would look back on those months, working with mission planners, as one of the most demanding and rewarding experiences of his life. Now, listening to the words from Apollo 9, he knew that McDivitt and Schweikert were on their final approach to the command module. Inside Gumdrop, Dave Scott could see the returning lunar module. "You're upside down again." "I was just thinking one of us isn't right side up," McDivitt answered. "Boy, you've got contraptions hanging out all over." "That's showbiz. Okay, I have us at about 370 feet. Around the Space Center, Buzz Aldrin, the first astronaut with a Ph.D. after his name, was known as an intense, brilliant theoretician whose interest in rendezvous was nothing short of fanatical. The other astronauts called him Dr. Rendezvous, and Aldrin lived up to the name. For anyone who would listen, he offered a discourse on his ideas brimming with orbital mechanics jargon, whether his listener could keep up with him or not. Once, when Aldrin's wife was away, Walt Cunningham invited him to dinner, then was called out of town unexpectedly. Somehow Aldrin never got word of the change. At the appointed hour he showed up for dinner, where he enthusiastically lectured Cunningham's wife, Lo, on out-of-plane errors and line-of-sight velocities until the small hours of the morning. It was hard to think of anything besides rendezvous that had been the subject of more meetings and discussions within and outside the astronaut office. Knowing the ins and outs of rendezvous was almost synonymous with being an accomplished astronaut. No astronaut knew more about it than Aldrin, and yet, to his regret, he had always felt like something of an outsider in the office. Aldrin was sure it was because of his resume. Not only was he not a test pilot, but he wasn't a member of the Navy clique that he felt dominated the astronaut corps. Other astronauts would later say it had more to do with his personal style. To them, his self-confidence had a way of seeming like arrogance. He could be direct to the point of bluntness. Aldrin saw no reason to conceal his pride at his academic achievements, but the old heads rolled their eyes when he showed up wearing a tie clasp fashioned from a pair of Air Force wings with his Phi Beta Kappa key dangling from it. And if the other pilots knew less about the theory of space rendezvous than he did, then they also understood that an astronaut didn't have to be a theoretician in order to fly. If Aldrin drove the old heads up the wall, he was also right more often than they would have cared to admit. But he sometimes fell prey to that well-known syndrome of technical organizations known as not invented here. When the astronauts were concerned about lighting conditions during the rendezvous' final stages, Aldrin suggested that the lunar module fly upside down as it approached the command module. In zero-G, of course, it would make no difference, and it would keep the sun's glare out of the lander's windows. The old heads scoffed at the idea. Fly upside down? But eventually, when it was time to make a decision, they went ahead and quietly adopted the plan, as if that had clearly been the way to go all along. When Aldrin finally did get a chance to fly in Gemini 12, he got a chance to put his rendezvous expertise to good use. He and Jim Lovell had just reached orbit and were chasing their Agena target rocket when their rendezvous radar malfunctioned, which in turn prevented the men from obtaining crucial data from their computer. While Lovell did the flying, Aldrin got out a set of rendezvous charts, which his own efforts at MIT and NASA had helped to create, and computed the maneuvers himself, and the pair completed their rendezvous successfully. And after a string of aborted spacewalks on earlier flights, Aldrin made the most successful walks of the Gemini program. Chris Kraft himself would later say Aldrin had turned in a superb performance. "Dave, I just can't see it. Let me get in a little closer." As Spider maneuvered into position for docking, Scott radioed instructions to guide McDivitt, who was blinded by the sun's glare. "Just keep coming easy like that. You ought to